Penny's come along and she's going to share her strength, hope and experience for the next 40 minutes. So, hand over to you, Penny.
Thank you, Simon. Hi, my name's Penny and I'm a very grateful recovering addict. I was a bit nervous when they asked me to share in this meeting because various reasons. I sometimes go into that place where I think I haven't got anything to say, you know. I don't know, you know, maybe I didn't use enough drugs and maybe they were the wrong drugs or maybe, you know, they might judge me or, you know, and all of this stuff is kind of part of the head madness that I can go into when I'm scared, basically. And, you know, and I know that through staying clean and doing the things that have been suggested to me since I first got here, I can just put one foot in front of another and learn how to recover. You know, my experience is all I've got to share, so hopefully it won't upset anybody, and I might kind of be able to help somebody, or, you know, you might just like the sound of my voice, you know. But I suppose really, when I've looked at it, and I was traumatised when I was a child, so I know that I shut down quite young. And I remember I had an Italian uncle who was a chef, and we had these kind of family gatherings where the whole family sort of sat around the room, you know, and everybody was having alcohol and, you know, and smoking cigarettes and having a nice time, you know, or it seemed to me like that. And they had this little glass that I had for me, and they made something like, it was like with cherryade and cherry brandy, and they called it something. And it was like I was quite young, you know, but it changed how I felt. And I think it planted the seed really, really early in me that, you know, something outside of me, a substance, could actually change the way I feel. And it did. And it was part of, like, the having fun and all of that. The social part of using that Gareth was talking about, you know, that is kind of like what I think probably a lot of us grieve when we first come in, you know, because then you look at the lovely time that you had once, you know, that you've been chasing ever since, you know. I don't know, you know, it's quite young to pick up, you know, my first proper alcoholic drink, I think, was like, you know, when I was about 14, and a friend of mine was going to go off and meet, you know, a couple of boys, and we were both going together, and she said, she rang me up and said her mother wouldn't let her out, you know, like 14-year-old girls do, and she told me, I was given the job to go out and tell these boys, you know, that we couldn't turn up, and and so, you know, I'd heard this thing about Dutch courage and everything else, and it was scary, you know, so when I looked at my dad's drinks cabinet, and there was a bottle of Pimm's. And I had one drink, and I thought, well, that's better, I feel better now, you know, I can go to... So I thought, like a good addict, right, I thought, oh, well, another one might actually be even better, you know. So I had another drink, and then I got to the bottom of the bottle, right, and didn't realise how I'd got to the bottom of the bottle, And I know I went out, but I don't remember very much, except that I was legless. And I do remember the lights at C&A's down the town somewhere, you know. And I don't know if anybody remembers C&A, because I'm quite old, you know. But this was quite, you know, sort of like the pattern was set, you know. Boys and a drug. I don't know if any girls can relate to that, you know. It's like the boys... sort of like the problem, and then the drugs come, and the drugs make it all right, you know, I don't know. And it was, I had a kind of, my experience went on from there. You know, I mean, I could give you a war story. Like, a lot of the drugs that I used were the ones that were available. Like, you know, my sister's slimming pills, like my sister's sleeping pills, my dad's sleeping pills. You know, going out using, you know, marijuana and cannabis. You know, and just, you know, the wonderful kind of times that were around when I started using, which I could get quite euphoric about, you know. I know that those times don't exist for me anymore. And that's the one thing I try and remember, you know, is just for today, I'm clean. And you know, that sort of like, I can still listen to music. This was a revelation to me when I first got clean, that I could still listen to music and enjoy the music, and I didn't have to get stoned to do it, you know. Because we're in the 60s, there was always this thing on the record, at the end of the record, you had to know about, you know, that there was this kind of like, you know, this sort of like the cool things that you had to do to be, you know, in. And it was like about smoking the right drugs and having the right parties and, you know, and the glamour, and, you know, through the kind of progression of the illness, I progressed through the drugs, and I needed different drugs at different times to, you know, get me to that place that I was looking for. You know, and I know that it talks a lot in the literature about isolation, and I'm an isolator, and what I do in recovery is I attempt to do the opposite to what my disease tells me to do. So if my disease tells me to stay in and shut, you know, and not talk to anybody, and, you know, and don't phone anybody, and don't, you know, be, I don't kind of listen to it anymore. I've started to recognise the voice of my illness as opposed to the voice of my recovery, which is, you know, been given to me through the fellowship and through working the programme, through a relationship with my higher power and the God of my understanding. And I'm really, I don't know where to start really with my recovery. I mean, you know, basically all the glamour went, you know, the rock stars went, you know, the kind of, all the atmosphere around in London. It's like, and what, you know, and the white knuckle and the feeling guilty and being, you know, ashamed of being useless, which is the places that my addiction took me to, you know, and not being able to tell anybody or do anything about it, you know, because I didn't think normal people, because I felt normal when I had drugs in me. I felt normal. And my mother had always said to me that I was different, you know, and I felt different, and it just confirmed how it was, you know. And it's taken me quite a while, you know, in recovery to understand what the nature of my illness is and how it works to kind of get me into those places where I don't want to be, you know. The drugs progressed and I ended up having a habit on heroin, and, you know, the kind of hell that puts you in. I saw it as this spiritual black pit that I couldn't get out of. I was like, it was like, you know, I don't know what this black substance was. It was like treacle or something. I was just like, couldn't climb up the sides of this pit. Every time I'd get to the top and just peek over the top and think, yeah, I can do it this time, I can do it this time, and I'd just slide back into it, and I wouldn't be able to kind of, you know, I don't know, just even have a glimmer of hope that I could get out of it. And so I used various things, you know. You know, it took me from the kind of using that where you felt all right and you were confident and you could go out and you could face people in society, to actually being not able to open your eyes in the morning to, or having them shot open with fear about whatever was going on, and having a nightmare going on in your head, you know, just behind your eyes, and the other one going on in your gut, and knowing that you can't, that you can't do anything about it, that you've got to use that day, you know, and being driven by that, and some days not being able to even get up and want to use, you know what I mean? Needing to use was different from wanting to use, and that place where you're using against your will, you know. And, you know, my daughter used to kind of scream at me a lot, you know, and it felt at the time like she had a voice that shattered glass, you know, and my head would be kind of like, you know, so I would start to try and stop using, and what would happen is I'd be right kind of like coming off and sick, you know, off these drugs and in so much of a mess, looking more like I was using more drugs than when I was trying to, you know, and having her thinking I was using more than, you know, and not being convinced, her not being convinced, you know, that I was not using, and so it was easier to use and to cover that stuff because, you know, you could function for a while. That's how it was. I mean, I could tell you a lot of fun times I had using, but the gap between that wasn't, it was a long time, but it wasn't, if you know what I mean, in terms of my experience. It just felt like suddenly that I was in this place where, you know, it was hell, my body had suffered a lot, you know, my liver, my kidneys. I had no self-esteem, and, you know, I'd go and pick the kids up from school, and I'd ended up in this place. I've done a geographical, and I've got this, like, New York trilby that I used to pull down like this, and a trench coat, and I'd go, it would take so much effort to get up to the school, because I was so driven by guilt to go and pick the kids up. And all the mothers were Essex girls, because I'd gone to this place where they were all wearing like shell suits, and they were all pastel colours, and, you know, trainers, and I just kept there, and the kids would walk by me, you know, and they'd say, "Pretend you don't know us, you know, we don't, you know, you're." And you don't know. The same thing happened in the swimming pool. I've been making this real huge effort to be a good mum, take them swimming. Go in the swimming pool, and I'm falling out of my bikini because I'm drinking, trying to stop using. And I'm on the methadone, and you know, the methadone starts to wear out about 4 o'clock when you pick them up from school. And so you go down the pub, and you know, you've got a bottle, and you go to the swimming pool, and then you're falling out your bikini everywhere. With the toy boy, I must admit, you know, it's kind of like, oh, what are you going to do now, you know, and they're swimming past going, pretend you don't know me, you know. So my kind of like, it was like, well, what am I supposed to do, you know, and I felt like Lady Dracula. I was living in this house, and we only ever used to go out at night to score, to London, to score, because you couldn't score where, you know, it was terrible. They cut it with brick dust and stuff. And I don't know what happened to me. I kind of ended up living in a caravan. From there, I lived in a caravan. And I mean, somebody gave me this book, which is kind of a bit like The Cross and the Switchblade. In America, they have them in prison. It's like, it's Bo Lozov or somebody. And he talks about in prison, you know, you're in prison. And it was talking to me because I knew that it was spiritual what was wrong with me. But I'd gone to church, and I'd gone, you know, I'd talked to the local witch, and I'd gone to yoga. And what happened was that I was kind of aware that I was in this jail. I had this visual thing of me being in jail. My jail was my addiction, you know. And the drugs that kept me there, you know. So anyway, well, to cut a long story short, I tried white knuckling to try and get off the methadone and all these things that you do, and then I'd try and get a job, and the job wouldn't work because I'd have to take methadone to get to work, and it would be, you know, how do I get off this, you know, because it was, like, it wasn't fun. It wasn't fun anymore. And, you know, I'd started crying. I had this screaming going on inside of me that I got used to. I didn't know that I was really ill. I did sort of say to someone once, I think I'm ill, you know. And I knew that I was physically ill. And the mental stuff was like, had come from using on top of like following number plates when I was psychotic on speed at some point, you know. And all the stuff and the paranoia had gone on, and I'd used on that, you know, on top of that, and you know, but those nightmares were still there. They were, you know, like, you know, not dealt with them. So anyway, I was in this caravan, and you know, the boyfriend's been arrested and he's in the jail, and social worker has taken me to see him, and I'm in the car, and I'm going, I don't know what happened to my life. Used to be honest, and I used to have a sense of honour, you know. I used to have principles, you know. And he said to me, oh, it's funny you should mention that. He said, oh, I go to these meetings where they've got, you know, 24 principles. Actually, I think he might have mentioned 12. And I'd already been an investigated, you know, religion, and I'd read The Imitation of Christ, and also the spiritual 12 spiritual principles of Saint Ignatius, which, you know, I just looked at them and I thought, I can't do this. Have I got to do this to get better? You know, I can't. That's too hard. And so I thought that's what he was talking about. And anyway, I started rabbiting about something. You know, you don't listen. And he was saying to me, yeah, I'll take you to a meeting. And he took me to this meeting, and they were all barking mad at this meeting. I have to say, if I remember rightly, you know, now I kind of recall. But there were a couple of people there that seemed to have this kind of glow, you know, and they were really well, and they kind of seemed to know what they were talking about, and they were laughing, and they were happy. And I thought, and I knew that they were addicts, you know, and... because they said they were, you know, but I don't know if I was listening or what. And I got back from this meeting, and I went to the opposite caravan where they were making circuit boards, and or the mother made circuit boards for computers and stuff. And I got into kind of thinking about this meeting, and I was standing by with all the cats, and they were all plotting how they're going to pull the phone box at the end of the road down to get some money to go to school, you know. Because they were all teenagers. I mean, I was like middle-aged, and I was using the teenagers, you know. And it wasn't a happy place to be. But I thought about this meeting, and I thought, what was I doing in that meeting with all those derelicts, you know? And I heard this voice, and it said to me, you are one. And I kind of looked round to see who was there. And I was like, what was that, you know? But I had that moment, you know, they talk about that moment of clarity, and it's like I had that moment where I actually knew that I was, because I was living in this caravan, and I hadn't taken off this pair of trainers for 2 years, well, practically, you know, I mean, I wore these trainers all the time, and I crashed out in them. I never took my makeup off if I had makeup on. You know, I was always face down, I was always crying, I was always in some drama somewhere, and it was like, I had that moment where it all kind of, oh yeah, you know, and that's, you know, and I don't know quite what happened. I don't remember my second meeting, but I started getting picked up every week. I went to a meeting every week because where I was, there weren't any meetings, you know, like we've got now. In London, we've got like, I don't know how many a week, something fantastic. And you know, so you've got a choice of meetings and it's very luxurious. I went to the same meeting every week and they made me the tea person. And I was so concerned because my codependency wasn't evident to me then. I was so concerned that they wouldn't get their cup of tea that I turned up every week and I wasn't clean. I couldn't get clean, first of all. It was like every time I thought I'd nearly made it through a day, fuck it, doesn't matter. I'll try again tomorrow. Until it got so painful that I made it to 24 hours. I went to the meeting clean and I got my white key ring. And I thought, nobody is going to take this white key ring off me. Nobody. I don't care. I'm going to hang on to it. It was like glowing in my hand, you know, I could see it. And then it's like all the people, they come, they're just like, oh, you know. And that you can't score, you know, when you're on a rock bottom. But when, as soon as you get clean, everybody wants to give you drugs, you know. And they arrive and you're going to get credit and you're going to get this. And they want you to use because you're deserting them, you know. You're abandoning their kind of lifestyle and, you know, and everything else and all of that. And I remember the craziness that was going on with me. I kind of couldn't think straight. You know, I'd try and read. I couldn't read. I could, you know, I'd start the sentence and it would be like, you know, oh, this blah, 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 full stop. And by the time I got to the full stop, I didn't know what the first word was. I didn't know what it was about. My head was thinking, that bastard, he did that. You know, why did he do that? And, you know, what am I going to do next week? I've got like all these bills to pay and I've got no money. How can they leave me like this? And I can't. So what I mean is like madness, right? I'm not in the moment, you know. And one of the joys in my recovery has been that I've been able to go to university and learn, you know, and read books. And one of the reading lists had 30 books on it, you know. And then they just kept adding books. And I had to read these books and I read them, you know. And I understood them. And I could tell you about them, and I could write a book review about them, you know. And that stuff is kind of really important for me, to know that that I wasn't crazy, you know. And spiritually, I think I always had that an idea that God existed. It was like, even in the worst times in my using, I would say this prayer I learned when I was little, you know. It was all mixed up with Bob Marley, you know, like Rasta, an ideology of, you know, way of being. And then this particular singer, his birthday was the same day as mine, so, you know, and we had a flag that, you know, we had a flagpole outside the caravan, you know. We grew the plants and we had a ceremonial cutting down. The knife was blessed and, you know, it was a ceremonial cutting down of the plants. And I mean, they were huge, you know. And this village had a little police station in it, which was like Policeman Paul. He just used to turn up every day and unlock the door and he'd be in there for several hours. And he was on his own and everything. But he knew everything was going on in the village. In the conservatory, there's these trees, you know. And what happened to this plant, right, was like it got packaged up into it and put in the airing cupboard. And we got busted for this. You know, we got busted for some plants. This is a later story, but what happened was we'd cut my son's pocket money off. Right, because he had, like, it was either like, you can't have any pocket money for 26 weeks. Or you can go to the, you know, the pictures, you can do this, and you can have everything. You know, there was no kind of like balance in it. So this was one particular time his pocket money had been cut off completely. So what happened was one day he went in the airing cupboard and sold it to his best friend. Got his pocket money like that. So God, there was so much trouble over that. It was just like, you know, all the guys that used, you know, in the village, they were all like, you know, where's our gear, you know? We've been waiting months for this stuff, you know? It's like, we'd done all kinds of stuff, you know, dug up 5-year-old chicken shit to grow it, you know, and all this, anyway. But there were some other plants that I got done for, and I know that I was talking about it one day to my daughter, and I was saying, oh, it was only a couple of sticks in the bin. And actually, you know, my daughter said to me, Mum, there were two transit vans they took away. And it was like my memory, you know, my memory, when I was writing my first fourth step, I didn't remember any of it. And it was like, I'd been doing this wonderful step three, and my sponsor saw me doing a chair, and I had a pencil in my hair, and she said, it's time to do step four. So I did. Next day, I found myself in London, right outside the place that I used to use, right? And this is from being out in the country, not doing anything, and, you know. And I was kind of like, I was going, oh, look, and I did that over there, and this over here, and there were lots of things that happened, and that started to come back to me, you know, like God was working in my life through showing me how to, you know, how to recover, basically, and I wrote this step four, and I had terrible trouble with the literature because I couldn't get anybody to tell me how to write it. My sponsor told me to pray and write, but I didn't know quite what I was supposed to be writing. I was reading the working guide. You know, we didn't have the working guide then. It was the how to work step four in Narcotics Anonymous, and I didn't understand all the things. I thought, what does that, all of this mean? I've never had resentments to, you know, organisations and things, because it was so official in its kind of approach. But if somebody had said to me, you know, you had a resentment to, you know, the teachers at school, you didn't, you know, I would have understood that, you know, as part of authority and stuff. My head was so, I don't know, it took a long time. I think I always say it took me 5 years to get my brain out of hock, you know. It did, it really did, because I didn't function properly. And this kind of belief in a higher power and God wasn't clear to me. It really wasn't clear what it was I was believing in, you know. But I knew it was there. And people said to me, it doesn't really matter as long as it's working and it's keeping you clean. And when I finished this step four, I shared it in the step five, and I had what I can only experience as saying it was a spiritual experience. I suddenly became aware that there was something present with me and my sponsor when I shared this, and I felt that, I really felt that, and I felt it lifted off me the same way that I felt the obsession to use drugs was lifted off me. But it was only in retrospect I saw it, and it was very strange the way that that my program has worked for me. It's like I've worked steps, and then I've realized that the power of the steps that I've worked before works still, you know. And so what happened after I did the step five was my caravan burnt down, and I lost everything in my life, you know. Like, you wouldn't know what it was like just to not have anything to put something in, or, you know, to cook something on, or, you know, put a cigarette out in, or a flower in, or, you know, sit on, or cook dinner, or any of it. So I realised then that I was really scared, you know, that I didn't have any possessions. And through that experience, I got to understand that it's an inside job, it's inside of me, and that what I had inside of me couldn't be taken away from me, you know, that it was like I had this power of the program that kept me from not going crazy, not using. I stayed in the moment, and I learned with step three that that's the best place to be, and that everything's possible in that moment. And what happened was, I was talking to this social worker, and I thought, I was never going to get social workers out of my life. This social worker, actually, we'd been taken away from this thing, and so it was a series of miracles happened that night. The guy who should have been doing the job of looking after someone whose house burns down was on holiday, and his locum was sick. And the head of housing was there, you know, and he came out and he took an interest in it, and I thought it was a terrible thing, this woman with her two children. And I sort of jumped the housing list by about 400 people. And I you could say, well, you know, she's so far to the caravan or whatever, but I didn't. It was like, what happened? It was like, people had said to me, put your name down on the list. And I said, no, I don't want to. You know, people in the program, no, I don't want to put, you know, I don't want to live in a town. I'm too paranoid. Don't put me in a house next door to somebody. So what happened? She was about to tell me we were going to go and overcrowded bed and breakfast, and I was kind of being prepared for this, which I didn't know this, but then suddenly the phone rang, and it was this head of housing, and he'd given me a three-bedroom house. So, you know, I was staying in the moment. I just kept saying to God, I am terrified, please, please stay with me. I can't do this. I don't know how to do this. You know, and I've learned that if I stay in that place and I'm handing it over to God, and that, you know, the steps are the same all the way through, you know, the spiritual steps. It's all about inviting God into that moment, into that space, you know. And, you know, it's the same with my defects of character. I have a lot of defects of character which have taken a long time. It's been like water on stone, you know. It's like, I do the stuff, and it doesn't always get removed, you know. Everybody gets, you know, goes, blah, 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 you know, with me. And it's like, but I am aware that I'm, you know, I am getting better. Might not seem like it on the outside, but there's so much evidence of it that goes on in my life, you know. And I'm very happy, and I'm very joyous in the moment, and I can have, you know, good things in my life. I enjoy my food, you know, I exercise, I do all the stuff that is suggested to have a healthy life, and to take responsibility for my health, my mental health as well, and the emotional stuff that happens after a while, you know. And, you know, I kind of know that that's been a journey as well, and that, you know, I've had to fall apart for things to fall into place, where I've kind of been restored to sanity around a lot of stuff, you know. And I think they call it spiritual growth. And, you know, one of the gifts I've been given is the ability to meditate, you know, and not a form of meditation that I can do, basically, you know, for me works. And I do that twice a day, and I pray every day, you know, that I can have another day free of this illness. And at night, I'm really grateful that I've had another day, you know, regardless of what I think might be wrong in the day, you know, that it might all be kind of crazy, and how you know, and I'm still chaotic, and my head's judging me, and I'm going, no, you know. But if I let go and I stand back, if I think, you know, tomorrow, it might all fall into place, some of the jigsaw puzzle that's happened today, you know. And I am on a journey, and this is a process. And I'm really happy to be here. And to hear, I don't know if I...
Yeah.
How much time are we there?
Sort of
there about. About there about?
Yeah.
So I'd just like to say thank you to you all for listening to me, and anybody that has heard this and heard the message of recovery for the first time, or has first come to a meeting. Maybe all of this doesn't make sense. The fact is that I use drugs every day for 27 years, and I've been clean since 1st of April 1989, and to me that's an absolute miracle, but it's not such a miracle as the day, you know, and all the things that happen in the day, and the people that I know and have met through recovery. So thanks for letting me share, and I hope I've said something useful.
Thanks, Penny.